Hello, Internet. My name is Walter Ciady Svedchuk, and I do want to apologize for the sort of rough sound of my voice. If at any point between this week's podcast or next week's podcast, I struggle a little bit. I am still recovering from attending the Bills ass-whooping of the New York Jets. I know that's not all that impressive, but you know what? I need a little bit of joy in my sports life because the Bills haven't been that great this year, and the Orange of Syracuse, their men's basketball team, doesn't look that amazing yet either. But I'll save the football talk for the gaming podcast because that is typically what Chase and I like to discuss as the intro over there. And before we talk about today's movie, I am, of course, going to introduce my my good friend and podcast co-host, Chase Wassenaar. Chase, how have you been doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well. Worlds has come to a close. We're seeing all of the off-season drama and the like in the League of Legends world. Meanwhile, I'm just getting excited because when we're recording this, it is the day before Turkey Day. Which is a much more fun way to celebrate the holiday than its traditional roots in my, from as far as I'm concerned. A friend of mine has organized a Friendsgiving, with a dress code of cozy pajamas. So I've got my I Am Knuff sweatshirt straight out of the Barbie film. I've got some, bulldog slippers that I got as a thank you present for being in the wedding party of a lovely friend of mine. I am prepared. I am ready. And it's nice to be able to have some fun things to look forward to during this holiday season we find ourselves in.
That's fantastic. And I do appreciate you utilizing Turkey Day as opposed to the less respectful name of Thanksgiving. You know, that sort of re-education of American history is incredibly necessary. And honestly, Chase, it's one of the things that I am thankful for this year is my my continued deep dive into the world of Behind the Bastards. That has sort of been my earwig the last few months. And learning about two enormous corporate disasters, the most recent, not most recent episodes, but from a couple weeks ago, talking about the Hawk's Nest Tunnel incident and a mentioning of the Blair Mountain, Battle of Blair Mountain, which made me go, wait, did Behind the Bastards cover that? So that's what I listened to today while I was working on some projects at work. I spent, 5 hours listening to Robert Evans discuss the evils of corporate America. And I couldn't be happier. I couldn't be happier that I got paid to do that. So I am thankful for Robert Evans and Behind the Bastards at the very least.
Unfortunately, never going to run out of content. That's Behind the Bastards is a self-fulfilling show. We keep finding more of those, but at least we have people to help make it entertaining and to find the shenanigans therein. I think this week was on an old British lord who loved to gamble and run an illegal zoo, which led to a lot of animals maiming a surprising number of people by the end. So, you know, he keeps it fresh, keeps it fun over at Behind the Bastards. And certainly if you're going to listen to any other podcast, I think that's one that both of us are happy to wholeheartedly recommend.
Listen, I can't think of a greater bastard than someone that would try to operate an unregulated, unlicensed private zoo. I think he deserves the lions to chew his face off. But with that being said, this is not a podcast about a podcast known as Behind the Bastards. This is a podcast where Chase and I discuss movies. It's Final Cut. I don't know if I said that in the intro. This is Final Cut.
They've read the name. They've read the name.
But that being said, we watched a movie, and Chase and I, after Killers of the Flower Moon, we sat down, we went through a whole bunch of movies that are coming out between now and the end of the year. I brought up The Bike Riders, but now that movie isn't actually on the docket anymore. That one's being shuffled around to see if somebody else wants to publish it or put it in movie theaters. I don't know. The entertainment industry is fucking crazy nowadays. But as we were trying to figure out what exactly we wanted to do, we needed kind of a stopgap film, right? Something that we could get to easily on Netflix because we did have kind of limited time until the holiday season, and the movie we're going to discuss next time came out tomorrow, Turkey Day, and we'll get to that in the next episode. But Chase, what about The Killer drew you to wanting to watch the film?
Well, first of all, David Fincher is a fascinating individual, right? I don't know how many David Fincher films you've seen. Gone Girl is one of the best films I've ever watched.
Never seen it.
It's incredible, and I highly recommend that you do. He's in a lot of his films, whether it's Fight Club or Seven, if you will.
Never seen him.
He does a very good job of capturing people from a distance, right? There's a way of looking at the kind of underbelly of people and how they respond to things, and with a level of detachment that is fascinating, right? And sometimes that means you get stuff like The Social Network, which I don't think condemns its subject matter nearly as much as I wish it did. And sometimes you get Mank, which is awful, just a terrible film, so full of itself. I've never seen it. Yeah, there's a reason for that, and you won't, and you shouldn't, and no one should. And if you have seen Mank, I'm sorry. It did get nominated for Best Picture in 2020 because the Oscars sure love rewarding films that talk about how cool films are. But that's the thing with David Fincher, right? He's a fascinating director, and everything he does is either really good or messy. And people have polarizing opinions about it, right? I just talked about how I dislike The Social Network, and you responded with saying you thought it was great. And a lot of people have that back and forth with him. He's an interesting guy. And you pair him up with Michael Fassbender, who's a very interesting and captivating actor, someone who had stepped away from acting for a few years, kind of focusing on himself. Did a little bit of racing over in the Proton competition, so good for him. But, you know, a guy who's always been captivating to see on screen, and we haven't seen him since X-Men Dark Phoenix, right? So, interesting people coming together to make a film. I'm going to want to see that. And, you know, you said it, you mentioned how easy it was to watch on Netflix. I live in Los Angeles, so I got to see this one in theaters. And the ability to do that and get to justify that expense as part of this podcast that we do here certainly appealed to me as well. And whatever else you can say about this film, Walter, it certainly is interesting. It's certainly different than anything I think I've seen before, which ultimately, what more can you ask for from a film?
You know, it's funny. So he mentioned some of, you know, the movies that he's done, and I interjected there because I admitted to Chase prior to the podcast, I'm going to have to admit to a lot of movies I haven't seen that are probably going to change people's perceptions of me. I've never watched Fight Club. Never once in my life have I watched that movie. There you go. That's a piece of information that I'm going to give to you guys about me, about the man behind the microphone here. And with that being said, my exposure to David Fincher is mainly through The Social Network and through House of Cards. I love House of Cards. I fucking love it. I know Kevin Spacey could potentially be a monster and probably is a monster. For legal reasons. And that the ending that we get because of Spacey's ejection from the movie and entertainment industry because of the allegations is bordering on a final season of Game of Thrones bad. It is bad and basically ruins the show. But it does sort of have this glimmer and this kind of veneer to it that you can identify David Fincher's fingerprints on it. All of his movies kind of look the same. There is this almost, there's like a gradient to them where if you were going to give me still shots of four or five movies, I could probably pick out which one David Fincher worked on just by a screenshot. And between that and between Michael Fassbender, and I will say Tilda Swinton, but we'll get to Tilda Swinton later on in the podcast. When I saw the trailer for this film, I was like, I'm fucking intrigued. Is this a serial killer, like horror kind of psych, you know, sociological thriller type thing? Like, what is this about? And what we actually get to sit down is it's a hitman story, right? It is a story about the killer who is a hitman. And you go, okay, Walter, like, come on, we've seen a bunch of Hitman movies. We obviously have the Hitman video games. We obviously have John Wick. Like, I know Michael Fassbender's been in a bunch of action movies in the past, particularly the X-Men series. Like, I don't think he's the greatest action guy. Like, what, they're trying to make Michael Fassbender like Keanu Reeves, which was also kind of my, like, okay, I'm kind of intrigued how David Fincher would make kind of an action film. And don't worry, he doesn't. This is not an action film in the way that John Wick is an action film. There is action in this film. There is some intensity to it. And there is some of the kind of tropes and plot points that you would find in a hitman style film. But there is something more relatable to it. There's something more real to it. There is something more grounded to this. And I think that is something that Fincher is very good at. It's taking what should and what very well could be these sort of lofty, out of reach, I don't want to say professions, but characters, right? Characterizations of things, whether it's, you know, vice president and then president of the United States in House of Cards, whether it is, you know, an assassin here, whether it is the founder of Facebook, and he tries to ground them and turn it into something that is more relatable to immortal. And I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I really like your use of the term grounded here, because I think that that's the most apt way to describe this film. Because when you think of Hitmen, right, you think of the John Wick series, right? You're talking about these action sequences, you're talking about these larger-than-life characters fighting at this absurd level, and, you know, pushing themselves to their absolute limit, or, you know, the clean James Bond types, right, that are here to complete a mission and do so in style and glamour. And the killer spends more time than anything else in this film showing the incredible boring nature of what it would actually be like to be a hitman, right? Because 95% of your job as a hitman is not the cool hitmaning things, right? If we are to go with the premise that films typically give us, that being a professional murderer for hire is a cool and badass thing to do, the majority of the job that most films cut away from and that this film spends a lot of its time focusing on is the cleanup, right? It's covering your tracks. It's removing any evidence that you are on the scene. It's the stakeout, which is how this film opens, right? You spend, you know, almost 10 minutes in this WeWork building that has been closed down, and he's just monologuing to himself, occasionally listening to the Smiths as he does throughout the film. Great soundtrack choice, of course. But, you know, he's living in this rundown building because it happens to be abandoned and happens to have a view of what he needs to go into. And he's constantly having to clean up his tracks. He's eating the things that leave the smallest impact possible and that he can do in the fastest amount of time because he constantly needs to be ready. He's not able to sleep for more than like an hour at a time because he needs to make sure that he doesn't miss anything if his target comes back during that time. It is an exhausting, boring process. And throughout the film, anytime he actually does complete a kill, you've got to deal with body disposal. You need to clean down the area, including the car, if you're using that in order to, you know, manage your way through to carry the body to whatever second destination it's being dropped off at, right? You need to go to Hertz Car Rental or whatever other car rental place and get a car under a fake name that can be used to kind of hide your identity here, and then change the license plate to one of many license plates that you have all over the country, and these safe houses that then also have to be cleaned and locked up and held under different names and traveling under different passports, all of which, by the way, are fun kind of in references to different movie characters. But these are all things, right, that when you think about like a standard Hitman film, you typically wouldn't focus on those things because they're not flashy, they're not glamorous, and there may be an instinct to say that they're not the interesting part of the story. But I think what this film does really well is making that side of it interesting. It is creating someone in Michael Fassbender who the, you know, his character, which is just the killer, right? He's not given a name. He is just the assassin here. And he's just going through these motions, you know, just systemically, step by step, making sure that every possible beat is covered, that every angle that could come back to him is taken care of. And things go wrong when he fucks that up even a little bit, right? And the more emotionally invested he gets over the course of the film in getting revenge for his romantic partner being attacked, the sloppier he gets and the more likely those mistakes start to compound against the guy. And that is what's interesting. It's not the high stakes, badass action scene that you've seen 1,000 times before. It is someone who is so clinical and precise in their work in order to put themselves above the rest of the world, as he describes himself in that opening monologue. And seeing them constantly brought back down to earth by the sheer mundanity of what it takes to get away with this stuff and the very messy nature of each of his encounters as he continues to go during the film.
The word clinical, I love it, because it is the way the killer handles his job is it's a job, right? It's a fucking job. We never see how John Wick actually handles a contract, right? We never see how Liam Neeson's character in Taken like handles what his wet work was, right? Like, we just see them afterwards utilizing their skills to rescue their daughter, get revenge for their dead dog and their car getting stolen, get revenge for, you know, the contract being put on them, like all these things. We never see any of that preparation, and like, saying clinical is so on the nose here, because there's a moment where he's discussing how he, you know, how easy it is to like shoot someone, like, oh, you don't have to account for distance or you know, wind change with this high speed round or anything. It's simply you have to get your heart down to 60 beats a second and just light pressure on the trigger, and that's just so the glass doesn't get in the way, right? Like, that's, he has it down right to the heartbeat that he needs to do it cleanly. And so much of that early sequence of him fucking up, basically, even though it's not his fault, is breathing, right? And and all of a sudden his breath is ragged, and that you can hear the heartbeat increasing. And what in the intro sequence was this, his watch is beeping to let him know when he's at that resting heart rate. His watch is beeping to let him know when he's entering or exiting REM sleep. That way he can double check because he's waiting for a target to show up. Like, all these minute little things, and how everything goes together. He pulls out this white sheet to do his yoga and his stretching on. Well, that white sheet is then what he throws the, you know, jacket that he's going to wear to make sure he doesn't have any gunshot residue on him when he goes through airports and like all these things. And you see how even all of that clinical, you know, cleanliness that he tries and trying to have the plan and trying to exact everything, after he fucks up, he then ends up going to, you know, the airport, and he gets in line, and there's a dog by like the customs checkpoint for him to go. And he's like, I don't trust it. Cause now he's, you know, he missed a shot, so now he's not trusting himself on everything. So he's like, okay, I'm going to go a different way. I'm going to go through a different customs way. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to change my name. You know, all these things, that it doesn't matter how well planned he is across everything, the consequences of one screw up, you know, ripple throughout the entire course of the movie. I believe it is the lawyer Hodges that basically says, like, yeah, one, you know, you screwed up, there are consequences that are automatic. And that is very interesting, because, like, what does happen to an assassin that misses, right? Like, what does happen? You know, is it just, oh, yeah, we try again another time, it gets more difficult? It's one of those kind of, like, Mission Impossible type things where, like, ah, oh, we missed it this time. They're going to double the security. They're going to triple the security. We're going to have to try and get it at some other point thing. Or is there a second assassin that's waiting for you to fuck up, and their job is just to kill you? And that is approached in this film. And that is approached in a very, again, clinical and blunt way. You fucked up. There are consequences for that. and you're reaping those consequences. You know, whether or not he actually reaps those consequences, kind of, you know, that's the plot of the entire film. And it is, it's this, you in the pre-call, Chase, said it's this de-glamorizing of being a hitman, right? That it's not glamorous. It is sitting in one spot, waiting, and spending, you know, 2 pounds for 100 grams of protein at McDonald's or whatever the exact quote is, because you only have so much money to do it. You only have so much time that you can even be away from where your target is. You have all of these different things, and the killer sort of is annoyed by the mundanity of it because there's no creativity to it. He longs for a drowning, right? He says it, a simple, when's the last time I did a simple drowning?
Right.
To like you and me, I don't know. I don't think a drowning is all that simple, but to someone who is just so matter of fact and clinical, and he's a serial killer, right? It has this kind of serial killer vibe to it.
Well, he describes himself as a psychopath, right? He says that his cynicism and lack of empathy are what carry him, right? And if you are that, like, incapable of empathy outside of, I guess, the girlfriend that he's clearly managed to form a connection with and thus goes on this quest of revenge for, you know, you look at something like a drowning and go, yeah, of course a drowning is easier, because if it's underwater, I'm not leaving fingerprints the same way, because the water's going to wash all of that off, and people drown all the time, so you're not going to have the same likelihood that someone is investigating into a potential murder charge. Like, that makes sense, but it's the kind of thing that to think about it requires you to get inside a killer's head. And something the film does throughout, right? There's very little outside dialogue, ultimately. The vast majority of the film is just spent with Michael Fassbender talking to himself and thus the audience through his internal monologue, which is something that basically only Michael Fassbender can pull off, right? That is a level of charisma that is necessary in order to remain engaging. And I think that there are some people, if you look at, you know, on a Rotten Tomatoes and you see the difference between the, you know, average viewer rankings and the critic rankings, I think it's the kind of thing that can come off as pretentious to a viewer who's not expecting that kind of Fincher style, right? This kind of clinical nature of it coming into a, like, oh, you know, you're just kind of above it all, and this is, you know, kind of boring to just hear this guy go on over and over again. But the repetition, right, the specific things that he's going through, the mantras that he's taught himself, all reveal something about the character and his ethos and what it is that makes him a good assassin, and also why he fucked up, right? Why he's not the impervious badass that he presents himself as at the beginning of the film, right? He can make mistakes, and as the film goes on, he continues to make more and more of them. Now, it is kind of fascinating, the escalation throughout the film, right? Because it starts with the taxi driver, because you need to figure out who drove the assassins home, and once you figure that out, well, then you have to go to your handler, because your handler would know who it was that was, you know, would have access to your information such that they'd be able to find you in the first place. And then from there, you find the people who actually executed it, and then you find the person who financed the whole thing. It's a very systematic, going up the ladder, impartial way of processing this information and trying to take out everybody who wronged you. But, you know, as you pointed out, right, you know, this is presented to him by this lawyer, Hodges, who is his handler, kind of using the lawyer as a cover-up, clean profession to allow him to do what he does. You know, this is a consequence of failure. This is business. This is the way of the game. And, you know, the killer's inability to accept that and his willingness to circumvent all of these kinds of natural circumstances while by taking out everyone who could get in his way is such a, like, clear message of, you know, did I fuck up? Yeah. Does that mean you get to take revenge on me and that you can sell me out the way that the lawyer does and that you can, you know, treat my partner as brutally as the brute does, the other assassin who went to visit his place? Absolutely not. And that's where you realize that that like lack of empathy and lack of emotion is a facade to a certain extent, right? So it's a really interesting character to delve into, and you kind of need the internal monologue to catch the contradictions, right? If we were just watching it without that, you wouldn't be able to notice the ways in which he contradicts himself the way that we get to here.
Absolutely. And I think the you know, saying he's this impervious badass, I almost don't think he is trying to be an impervious badass, right? The beginning, I don't think he's trying to be like, yeah, I've done all these like badass things. Like even him saying like, oh, poisoning someone or, you know, slow poison or drowning someone. Like, I don't think that is a like, hey, check out my 100-0 record, right? I think it's more of just a dude that like is at some cocktail party and somebody comes up and is like, so what do you do for work? And he's like, oh, I'm an assassin. And somebody's like, oh, what's that like? Right. And then he explains what it's like. That is what that opening sequence is. He's explaining it. And it's boring. Right. It comes across as boring. If it wasn't an assassin. Right. If it was somebody talking about TPS reports. And if it was me telling you, Chase, what I do for work. You couldn't get away with a 20-minute intro to a movie to then get to the moment where I make the crucial mistake on the Excel spreadsheet that costs my company millions of dollars, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you couldn't fucking get away with that. But because we as an audience have this sort of preconceived notion of what an assassin should be, what a killer should be, right? That the mundanity doesn't really truly come through because we're like, okay, get to the exciting part, get to the exciting part, get to the part where you do the killing and you show us what a badass you are. And then it never actually comes because he fucks up. And then he is trying to maintain his clinical, you know, clean everything up. He goes into that auto repair place and he washes up and he cleans himself. And then he has, I'm going to guess it is like bleach, like a little aerosol bleach thing that he like sprays over the sink to try and get rid of it. Like he did earlier when he was brushing his teeth. And then, yes, we get to the moment where he gets home. He sees somebody has invaded his home and that Magdala has been attacked. And Marcus is like asking him for help and making sure that he, you know, he protects them. And while it is that sort of like disaffected, like I'll make them pay, there is like a real anger to him. There is a real like menace to him that I have seen in Fassbender in X-Men First Class when he first plays Magneto, right? There is this sort of, as you said, this charisma to him where he doesn't really have to say it with inflection. He doesn't have to say it in anger. But you can just see the look in his eyes that's like, oh, this dude is fucking furious right now. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that really translates through, particularly in how he deals with Hodges, right? He zip ties him up. He zip ties up Dolores into the bathroom. And I know we're going to say, oh, this is where he makes a mistake, right? He makes a mistake. But he takes a fucking nail gun and puts three nails in the middle of his chest and is like, you're going to drown in your own blood until you tell me what I need, right? Like, you're gonna do it. And the mistake he made is he didn't know that there was hypertension medication in the bathroom, which I don't know. Did Dolores, like, try... Was she trying to kill herself with it, or was she trying to, like, knock it down so he'd come in and see there was hypertension medication so that he'd know his calculations were off? I think she was trying to kill herself, but
yeah,
you know,
100%. Because she knows what this hitman is capable of, and she doesn't want to die in a painful way. Which, you know, I think, you know, to give the killer some credit here, right? Yeah, he totally 100% does kill her, but he like listens to her request to make it look like an accident so that her family can get the insurance money by breaking her neck and throwing her down a flight of stairs. Right? It's quick.
Which
it's
painless. By the way, yeah. I've seen enough law shows to know somebody's going to see that and go, that wasn't done by falling down the stairs.
Yeah, I possibly. But again, like, you don't necessarily need to, you know, for someone in her position falling down the stairs like that, maybe they don't investigate it. Maybe we, you know, there's a step that makes that less clean. I don't know. I think it certainly is the closest that he gets to, again, showing empathy for a guy that claims he doesn't have any. I will say, though, just to push back a little bit on something you'd said about him not seeing himself as, you know, kind of special or like this particular badass. He does start the film by saying that like there's the top percent and then there's everybody else, and you need to be in the top percent like me, which is important because at the end of the film, he admits to being just like everybody else. This adventure that he is on has taught him that he is not above everyone just because he knows how to pick people apart, because he can very much be caught up in his emotions and led to make mistakes in ways that come back to bite him. And that that is a humbling experience that is part of his kind of narrative arc that I do think is core to his character. But yeah, I mean, the brutality of Hodges with the staple gun is, you know, a very powerful moment. But it's followed by another very, you know, the one kind of fight scene that we get, right, with him versus the brute down in Florida, which is the least sexy fight scene you could possibly have, right? You know, if you're watching a film with a hitman, it feels like there's going to be that explosion, right? There's no way we're getting through this film without Michael Fassbender having to, you know, take some guy on. But this is just vicious, right? You know, it's bloody. It's a real like beatdown of a fight, right? You know, kind of the quote unquote real version of a lot of these like street fights that you'll see sometimes in like wrestling promotions and whatnot, right? Just dirty and messy and bloody and sweaty and in no way, shape, or form glamorous. There is no point in which you look at Michael Fassbender's character and it's like, oh yeah, look at how cool this is. Look at how much of a badass he is. He is fighting tooth and nail every step of that fight. And it's not a clean effort from him. He's just a little bit more resourceful in pulling out these kind of, pseudo weapons, using improvised stuff from around the kitchen and around the fire with the poker in order to deal as much damage as possible. And it can be difficult to watch, right? Because it is lengthy and it is painful. And, you know, it does ultimately lead in the killer pulling off the job successfully, but he has to burn the place down with a Molotov cocktail, which is not really what you want to do if you're trying to be, you know, a hitman leaving no trace behind, right? That is the most attention you could possibly draw to yourself, to burn an entire building to the ground like that. And I think that that's a really important scene to have, right? Not just because, you know, everyone wants to have the action moment, but because it is such a deconstruction of that kind of moment, right? The film is almost turning to the camera and saying, is this what you wanted? Is this really what you wanted? And the answer is, oh God, I don't know. I don't know that I like this anymore, actually. Maybe that clean shot from, you know, a couple buildings away was a lot more fun, even if he missed.
That's absolutely what I wanted. Absolutely what I wanted, because that leans into what the brute is, right? That leans into clearly what the brute did to Magdala, right? That he doesn't want to go to war with these people on his turf, right? If he did, he would just fucking poison them or shoot them from a mile away, right? This is the entire speech that the expert, Tilda Swinton's character, gets to, which I guess we can get to her now because she is the next piece in this puzzle after the brute is killed and after Hodges is killed, excuse me, is she, like, has a life. She has a husband that, you know, Fassbender's character is, like, interesting, like a bedroom partner. That doesn't seem right. Like, why would you ever do that? That adds unnecessary complications. And she goes out, and he follows her in the car, and she ends up at this restaurant, and she's sitting by a window, right? And, like, any good assassin, you'd be like, oh, well, that's the fucking cleanest shot I've ever taken in my life. Let me just pull out my gun real quick. Boom, and I'm gone, right? But no, he fucking goes in, and he sits across from her and talks to her, right? And just, like, they have a conversation right? And she's like discussing like all the mistakes that she's made, and tells this story, right, about a hunter and a bear, and how the hunter keeps missing the bear, and the bear offers him death or to be sodomized. And then after the third time the hunter comes out, the bear says, well, you know, this isn't about the hunting anymore. And it leads to this fascinating thought exercise of, yeah, if the killer really wanted to kill all these people, why is he making it so complicated? Why? He could just shoot them. He could have shot her at any point between her from getting into her car to, you know, showing up at the restaurant. He could have ran her off the road. He could have thrown a grenade under her vehicle. He could have done anything. But no, for some reason, he is being very exact and very precise, and he is coming to sit in front of his prey and look them in the eye, because this is fucking personal. And he is trying to find some sort of joy and some sort of meaning and some sort of confirmation that he is good at this. Which makes me all the more disappointed that we don't get more Tilda Swinton in this film.
Yeah, I mean, that Tilda Swinton scene is fantastic, to be sure. And I, you know, I think that it's such a perfect condemnation of the character in his own sense, because you're absolutely right. If he was able to be as removed from these experiences as he says that he is, right? If he was as clinical and professional and capable of removing himself from the situation and being above it all in order to do this job, he would not be in the room with her, where he has now been seen by multiple members of the wait staff who are all going to notice that she's not alive anymore. And they're going to have him as having been the last person seen with her, right? He has left a trail of evidence behind him. And increasingly, right, these get more and more messy as he gets closer and closer to the person that he thinks is most responsible for Magdala's injuries, right? Because ultimately, like, the brute is the guy who did it, but Tilda Swinton's character, the expert, is the one who knows how this stuff is managed and let it happen and recruited this guy to do the job, right? So it's a really interesting dynamic to see unpacked. And it gets, you know, of course it has to culminate with the client, which has its own really interesting nature to it, right? You get this billionaire, venture capitalist, crypto shilling asshole named Claiborne, who, you know, obviously has a lot of the protections that come from being super rich, but also doesn't have nearly the savviness that all of these other people that the killer has run into have, right? It's, you know, he has a bag that clearly labels what gym that he goes to. He orders delivery, which means people can easily get into his building, and it's not hard to replicate the kinds of key cards and whatnot that will allow them to gain access to him and his building. It's easy to take this guy down because this billionaire is coming from a very different world, right? He just wanted someone dead, and now everything that followed up after comes from sheer naivety, right? Which one reveals just the deviousness of the lawyer, right? This client could have easily been swayed into several other options, but was talked into the one that would hurt the killer the most. And the lawyer knew that. So there's a real kind of revelation of some of the evil and manipulative nature behind that, as much as, you know, getting revenge back at a professional killer can have. But it does lead to the most interesting aspect of the killer's ethos, right? Because ultimately, this guy is the biggest, just clear asshole that he's run into this entire time. The client has extorted a lot of people, done shady things to get his money, and is ultimately responsible for all of this through his own actions here. But because he is so naive And because he is so disconnected to this world and ultimately is not responsible for what happens to Magdala because he's not capable of the systemic understanding of what could have possibly happened to her or why the killer would be here at all, that Michael Fassbender leaves. Like, he gets to live. He's the one person in this entire chain of people involved in this crime that gets to make it out. And I think that's a really interesting statement, right? It certainly speaks to his idea that he doesn't have any political beliefs that would color his assessment of his job and how that would get in the way of his chosen occupation. But it also reveals how much of this is just personal, right? He is getting revenge because he wants to hurt the people that made him hurt. And while the client is the guy that, you know, gave a thumbs up and a nod to the lawyer's idea, he's not the person who, you know, was ultimately trying to get revenge on a job that was failed. He's not the person that was trying to get back at the killer. He's just a guy with a lot of money and not a lot of common sense and street savviness. And the fact that the killer is able to recognize that and thus let him go and consider all of this to be wrapped up, that he's okay calling his revenge streak there, it's a really interesting decision. It says a lot about, you know, what makes the character such a captivating person to watch for 2 hours.
I think, like, the fun, interesting part of this is that the closer the killer gets to the client, right, the further he gets away from the more he moves through his revenge, the further away he actually gets from the culprit, right? The culprit is Hodges. Hodges is completely the one that makes the decision here. But it's also fascinating how inadvertently each successive person is, like, the concept, like, how they are treated is more in line with, like, the actual involvement in the crime, right? Hodges is the one who fucking, like, set the attack dogs, right? He's the one that made the call. He's the one who essentially pulled the trigger on what happened to Magdala, and ultimately, like, what would have happened to the killer? Like, it's, I understand Magdala and Marcus are the ones who were attacked, and Magdala is the one that's in the hospital and is injured, but they were there to find information about the killer so they could go kill the killer. That is entirely what that was, and Magdala, unfortunately, happened to be the person that was in the house at that moment. So the lawyer drowns in his own blood, which is fucking gruesome. That is a fucking horrendous death. Right? And he says, oh, 6 to 8 minutes. And again, I go back to, it's hypertension medication is the only reason he actually doesn't bleed out longer, right? It is relatively a shorter death because of that one thing that the killer didn't know. But his pure intention was, I am going to let this man drown in his own blood. That is about as fucking personal, I think, an assassination as you can get. You move on to the brute, and the brute, it is. It's this long out, drawn out fight where the brute fucking takes a beating, right? He gets like a piece of a table, like, stabbed into, I don't know if it's his hip or his back or his kidney, but literally, like, right through him, and he has to pull that shit out. He gets just absolutely gashed and destroyed with a fire poker. Like, when Chase is saying that this is not a, like, pretty scene, it's not. It is dark. It is grimy. It is disgusting. It is not choreography. It is not the top-down Hotline Miami scene from John Wick 4. It's not. It is a brutal, bloody, disgusting, tetanus and hepatitis-filled mess. And then right when the brute might be able to survive, it's a gunshot. You know, Tilda Swinton's character, the expert, she was there, right? She just wanted to talk to her. She just wanted to, you know, get the information out of her. And we don't know what Tilda's character would have done. We don't know what the expert actually was going to do. But the reality is, like, it's pretty clear that she's not the one that brutalized Magdala, right? And Fassbender treats her in kind. He just shoots her. That's it. You're responsible for it, but like, you're not worth more than a bullet. And like, granted, she's totally trying to set him up to like kill him instead, and is sneaky, but like, he sees right through it. And then, yeah, the client was like, I had no idea what I was fucking doing. The lawyer told, like, gave me this option. I was like, okay, yeah, if you think that sounds right, which I'm sure is what Claiborne has done multiple times in his career. Somebody else came to him with a plan, and he just kind of said, yeah, okay, that sounds good. Because he goes, well, if it doesn't work, I'll fire that person, right? I'll just get rid of them. That's how he's treating everything. That's how he's treating the guy that he's talking to on the phone when Fassbender's character walks in. He's like, it's a bad, like, fuck you. Like, no, I'm the boss. You're making a mistake here. Like, I can fire you tomorrow. It doesn't matter. And the insight, the way that Fassbender is able to read the situation and understand that all Claiborne needs is a threat. And just like a threat that like Claiborne won't even know that he's come back. It's like, I'll just slowly poison you and I'll let your brain dissolve. He knows that's enough threat that this guy is going to back away and he's not going to try and hire another assassin for him. And he's going to empty out his bank accounts in North America and he's going to go retire. Like, I find that just a fascinating arc that the closer he thinks he's getting to the truth, the further away he actually is. And it's at that last moment that he realizes that. And like you said, his tour of revenge is over and he can go retire on a Dominican beach. It's a fascinating way to look at all this. And Chase, I said something in pre-call to you that you kind of rolled. I don't want to like put words in your mouth, but you're kind of against, right? You don't necessarily agree with. I think that this is an anti-capitalist message. I think this is a very pro, like, individual kind of collective thing, story here. So why don't you tell me why you think this is pro-capitalism?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I don't think it's necessarily a pro versus anti film. I think it's a film, you know, by his own admission, right? This is an assassin that does not feel like he has the ability to have his own kind of political moral philosophy, right? That would be bad for the job. If you had this like strong sense of justice and right and wrong and what factors should and should not be fought for, you would be bad at being able to take on jobs to the highest bidder and complete these assassinations without having to think about the moral consequences of it all, right? He purposely puts those thoughts to the side, and at no point in the film does he ever engage with that. The closest he gets is calling Claiborne an asshole and you know, kind of the rich, naive angle of it, but that's less of a condemnation of the fact that he's made money and more of a condemnation of, you know, from the aspect of his job. People with those kinds of resources don't protect themselves very well. It's a very clinical and specific criticism that is more like, man, this guy really doesn't know what he's doing because he's never had to think about the world the way that I do, right? And if you were to have an anti-capitalist message, right? If you were to believe that this film is trying to purport that those in positions of power through financial capital need to be held accountable, the client would be fucking killed, right? He is the person who funded the job. He is the person who is directly responsible through the fact that he took out the first contract in the first place, right? Without him, none of this happens. Without his selfishness and his greed, because it is implied that he was taking out like a competitor of his, right? Then none of these events come to pass. And ultimately, he is only interested in his own self-interest. There is at no point in which this venture capitalist asshole, as he has been revealed to be in these calls that we've gotten to listen into, has like a change of heart or a promise to do better by anything, right? Because the killer doesn't care about that. The killer only cares about his individual culpability in a specific way in which he has been harmed. And that's an individualist message, not a socialist one. There's not a collective belief that he needs to do right by the people because there's some system that he is against. He doesn't care about the system. He cares about what impacted him. And that's why he fucks off to a country where he can go live in luxury and not think about these things anymore. I struggle to see an anti-capitalist message in that, because if nothing, if anything, it is a, you know, fuck your systems, I got mine, which is peak capitalism, really, if you were to boil it down on a social level.
I guess that's fair. So I guess really the term I'm looking for is, this is a libertarian movie.
Sure. Libertarian, I totally believe in. Because yeah. It is very much the ethos of the individual. In this case, my feelings were hurt, so you fuckers need to die.
Yeah, this is more Atlas Shrugged than it is Brave New World. Okay, I can still go with that, because that still sorts of fits in with like my thoughts on it, right? And It is of, I disagree that at no point in this film does the killer show any allegiance to any philosophy or justice, right? The entire vengeance tour is justice. He is judging the people he comes across, right? I think the only person he really doesn't, you could try and argue that he doesn't judge, is Dolores, but he does, right? He judges her as an accomplice to Hodges, but the level of her accompliceness is, well, I'll give you your last wish, because I know at the end of the day, like, you were just a pawn, right? You were a tool in this, like the laptop, right? I know you weren't the one that like said, yeah, let's kill him, or yeah, let's kill his girlfriend or maid or whatever she actually is, because they're not really like super firm on that. It's intimated that it's potentially a romantic interest. But like, he judges Hodges, right? And he gives him an absolutely brutal death. He judges the brute and he gives him an absolutely brutal death. He judges the expert, doesn't give her a brutal death, but still kills her because she's guilty. And then comes to the finale, right? Comes to the last person in the chain and judges that the client, Claiborne, while he's an asshole, is not guilty at this time. But if he ever became guilty because he tried to come after him, well, then he would be guilty and he would then be killed. And he would be killed in a way that is apropos to his sins, right? That's really what it comes down to, is the punishment, the executioner aspect of this. He is judge, jury, and executioner, sorts of fits the crime and fits the level of culpability that these four individuals have in what happened to his friend.
Yes, but, and I think that an important distinction here, right? This is not something that he applies at large to the industry that creates these situations in the first place, right? He didn't care about any of these moral failings until it happened to him. He doesn't have a larger moral philosophy that the people in these roles are bad and needs to be punished. It's one of the reasons that, you know, Tilda Swinton is the expert. She has a brutal line about how, you know, one day you're going to be on the other side of this conversation and you're going to remember this, right? You're going to remember what it's like to be in my shoes, because that's the nature of the business in which we exist. And she's 100% correct, right? The only difference between her and him is that in that moment, he's gotten the upper hand and he's got the personal grudge. But he has done all of the same things that she does. She just happened to hit someone he cares about. And that's the difference. It is less of a consistent moral philosophy and more the equivalent of like an injured animal lashing out, right? Someone who is hurt and wants to inflict hurt on the people that hurt him. And I do think that distinction is interesting and creates kind of a powerful look at as to how, again, how emotionally driven this guy who claims to be removed from his emotions and that's why he's great at his job. And his having to accept that is why he changes at the end of the film to say, you know what, I'm not above anybody. I'm part of the masses. And, you know, hopefully you do better at this than I did, right?
When he decides to go after the client and it's just, fuck it.
Yeah, fuck it. I'm trying to hurt people who hurt me, and this guy's too dumb and naive and removed from the situation to have actually caused me pain. So I'm good, and I'm going to fuck off to whatever island country. I think he goes to the Dominican Republic, and he's going to retire. And, you know, someday somebody who was friends with Tilda Swinton's expert or the lawyer Hodges or, you know, the brute perhaps is going to come and find him, and it's going to be deeply personal to them and not to him. And that's the cycle that he has to live with. And it's what makes this stuff fascinating, right? It's this, there is no end to the system outside of being removed from it. In his line of work, quite literally removed. So yeah, really, really fascinating stuff in that regard.
Well, with that being said, Chase, as fascinating as it is, I am fascinated on what your final thoughts and your final score are.
Yeah, I'm going to give this one an 8 out of 10. I said a lot of positive things. I do think it is a fascinating film and one that I was glad I watched. I do think people should go see it, if only so you can form your own opinion on it. I don't think it's a perfect film. I think the opening drags on a little bit, and I think there are certain, you know, certain aspects of it that could have been a little bit sharper. Obviously, you're trying to instill this level of repetition, but I don't know that it needed to be quite as repetitive as it ends up being in certain spots. But ultimately, it's trying to do something very different, right? And, you know, it is based on a book, and I don't know how good the book is or isn't. I'd kind of be fascinated to see it. But I do think that as a character study, Michael Fassbender does a fantastic job, is captivating from start to finish. And I think that it is, like I said at the beginning, unlike anything I have seen before. And I'm glad that this film exists because I think it is a valuable deconstruction of the kind of films that you and I have enjoyed in the past.
Entirely reasonable. I do want to point out that much like Killers of the Flower Moon, this is another long form passion project for the director. Apparently, Fincher has been working on this film since 2007 in some capacity, and finally was able to bring it to Netflix last year, and was able to to actually get a deal and to pick the Fassbender for the lead role and you know, get a script to actually taken care of. And I'm gonna give it a 9.5 out of 10. I really fucking love this film, and I'm only docking it a half a point because I wish we had seen more Tilda Swinton. we've seen this. We saw the Genie movie with Idris Elba in it, 1,000 Years of Longing. Like, holy shit. I don't know if I haven't watched enough with her in it, but every time I see her on screen, I am just captivated by her presence and what she's able to do. And in this film, with as little as she was given, right, she's given like 10 minutes at the most, and she is as identifiable as Michael Fassbender in this film in just that pure 10 minutes and what they are able to jam into that character, and that sort of look in the mirror that the killer is supposed, you know, it's going to be having in that moment. I went into it and I was very kind of concerned about what kind of action movie it was going to be. And when it told me this isn't a fucking action movie, idiot, this is like a deep dive character study, I was like, oh, you mean what David Fincher's good at? Excellent. I can't fucking wait. And I think the repetitiveness is necessary because I think it plays into the process that the killer has to go through to do his job. And it is also kind of a hallmark of Fincher. He likes to be repetitive. He likes to have these very kind of isolated monologues with his main characters. Again, I fucking love House of Cards, and the number of times that Kevin Spacey is like standing on screen superimposed with the background and is just giving a monologue to the viewer is, you know, I think this hit a lot of those notes of what I liked about House of Cards. And really was an overly and, you know, incredibly enjoyable experience for me. I really enjoyed this movie, and I'm not going to punish it for some minor quibbles other than give Tilda Swinton more fucking time on screen.
Amen to that. You know what? You've talked me into it. Bumping up to a 9. I'm in. I was between an 8 and a 9. I went back and forth 10 times. I agreed with everything you said. Give it a 9. It's not too late. We're still recording. I'm allowed to.
We're still
to
recording.
Bump it up.
I have not written down the final scores on the spreadsheet yet. So, nine from Chase, 9.5 from me. With that being said, we would love to hear your thoughts. Chase, if the good folks at home happen to watch The Killer over this holiday week and want to reach out and talk to you, where can they find you at home?
You can find me at Chase Wassenaar on Twitter or chasewassenaar.bsky.social on the better Twitter. I do want to be a little bit more active on there. So hopefully, reach out. And you should also, of course, follow the podcast at Rough Drafts Pod on Twitter. And of course, in the Rough Drafts feed, not only do you get Final Cut, but every Monday we're not doing this. We're doing Steam Cleaners, which is the gaming podcast where Walter and I talk about different games that we've been playing. And every 2 weeks, we're talking about different games. So there's always something new to look forward to. So definitely go check that out. And should be some really fun episodes coming your way.
Absolutely. For this upcoming episode of Steam Cleaners, I have played a game that I've mentioned numerous times on the podcast. And I'm glad I went back to it. I'm glad I actually finally have played it fully. And we'll be able to talk with Chase about it because it is also a very fascinating character study. I think David Fincher could make a movie about it. With that being said, you guys can follow me on Twitter at CADs_LOL on Blue Sky, CADs.bsky.social, and also on the League of Legends client. They've done the Riot name change thing, so I'm now CADs NA number one. So that's the only way North America will ever be number one. With that being said, come back in 2 weeks. Chase. Mm-hmm. There's a movie called Napoleon.
There sure is.
And I'm super fucking excited to watch it and talk about it. So we'll see you in 2 weeks, guys, for Napoleon. Until then, goodbye, Internet.